Talk to me a little bit there. Hello, test.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Hello, one. This is Perky's part. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Hello, testing. 1, 2. Testing over 3, 5.
I think you're all right. Okay.
9, 10, 11, 12.
And I think I'm okay, too. Good. All right. You ready to roll?
Rock and roll.
Got your water. I got my coffee. We're ready. Okay. Well, it's February 25th, 2012.
Time flies when you're having fun.
And we're going to have some fun. This is Jack Fox, and we're talking to a longtime Louisville radio broadcaster, a very successful morning man at WHAS, Wayne Perky.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, it's always fun to be with you.
Yeah, we've had some good times.
Yes, we have.
Well, Wayne, let's talk about you for just a minute. Let's find out, first of all, you've lived in Louisville probably over half your life, but you're not from here originally, are you?
That's right. Gosh, I have been here over half my life.
Exactly. It hit me as I was driving in here this morning.
That's funny.
So you're from where originally?
Born in East Tennessee, Lake City, Clinton, and graduated Lake City High School. Hmm. Went to Carson Newman College my first year in school, and there was a note when we came in from supper one night. There was a note on the dormitory bulletin board saying there was going to be tryout for announcers for the campus radio station, where we were a 10-watt carrier current. You could get us all the way out to the drive-in movie and almost all the dorms, right? And my buddy Joe Pesterfield, who was from Chattanooga, Ben and I were together. Joe, you remember an actor named Aldo Ray? Big,
yeah,
strapping
sure,
meatball,
sure,
had a voice
yeah.
like this, you know. Yeah. He always played the really tough guy. Joe sounded a lot like Aldo Ray. He said, come on, Perk, let's go over and try out. I said, are you kidding? With our accents? Well, they took me and they didn't take Joe.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So, and it was really fun. I had a great time, you know.
Well, had you ever thought about anything like that before? I mean, as a
no.
kid, had you picked up all these radio stations around the country and thought, I'd like to do that someday?
No, I was always a radio fan. Mm-hmm. But no. Thought I was going to become a lawyer.
Really?
Yes. My uncle was a judge advocate, traveled the world. I thought, what an exciting
sure.
life he had,
yeah.
you know. And, I mean, they lived all over the world. So I was in pre-law and somewhere along the line realized that, I don't know who I talked to, but a good friend who was the librarian there, Carson Newman, who reminded me that lawyers spent a lot of time alone in stacks digging out information, writing briefs, doing all those things.
And that wasn't you.
It wasn't me. I was involved, meanwhile, in the radio station. I also was writing for the yearbook and doing some other things, a newspaper at school. And I loved it, but I ran out of money. So I went home, got a job working relief on a sanitation truck. It was really funny. We pulled up to my uncle's house. And
this is the judge advocate?
No, this is a different uncle. And his son Devin, who came out, said, Wayne, did you go to college to learn how to be a garbage man? I cashed my check, bought a bus ticket to Chicago, and went off to Chicago. There were about 100 guys there from my neighborhood, La Follette, Lake City, mm-hmm. Clinton, Oak Ridge, Knoxville, that I knew, who were working in Hammond, East Chicago, Joliet, all those areas.
Sure.
So I went to work for a railroad. This is much more than you want to know.
No,
so
we're finding out here.
Anyway, we hit the slowdown, and I got laid off, and so I cashed my check and took my money and went back home and went to school. I got a call one night from a fellow who was working for a radio station in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And this station had been purchased and was being moved to Knoxville. So he said, I know you've done some radio, would you like to come be the relief guy? So I signed off the radio station and got teased by all my buddies as having killed the radio station.
Well, now, at this point, you work at the college radio station. Were you considering a career in broadcasting at the time, or this job just came along and thought,
yeah.
well?
No, radio was just fun, you know?
Yeah.
And I grew up a good, solid Southern Baptist boy, you know, and, you know, fun was fun and work was work.
Right.
You know, it was fun. Work
it mixed
fun.
The two, yeah.
No, that's right. Work was work and fun was fun.
I'd have to say you got over that.
I bet it's
over your career, that's right.
Crossed that breach.
Yeah, sure.
So I closed that radio station and then went off then to the University of Tennessee. And I found a job in La Follette, Tennessee, a 250-watt radio station, WLAF. Working 48 hours a week on the air. Boy, you talk
wow.
about, yeah. I would
what
go.
What were you doing?
Four to midnight, disc jockey. Yeah,
so disc jockey,
yeah.
Playing music and things like that.
And it was a great learning experience for me. But it was 50 miles round trip, you know, every day. I was driving 100 miles a day.
Wow.
So I got my paycheck at Christmas after 4 months of this intense indoctrination and moved to Knoxville to go to school. Found a buddy.
At UT, you were going to go to UT?
I was at UT. Oh. And a buddy in a chemistry class told me about an opening at a radio station, WBIR, weekends. And I thought, perfect. So I applied and got a job and was there for a while. Then, you know.
What did you do there? Disc jockey?
Disc jockey and worked weekends. Went to another radio station. Wound up at WATE, which was a really, really good radio station.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And had the opportunity there also to work in television. So I had an opportunity to do that. And then I went to WHAS Television, WATE, Television News for a year. And
as a reporter or anchor? Or?
Right, was a reporter. Did a little anchoring, but not much.
Were you doing radio duties at this time, too, or just television?
By that time, I did a full year. I did a full year in television news. It was a great learning experience for me. I was able to do a lot of things that were creative and inventive that nobody had done before. That's where I was when Kennedy was shot. I remember vividly.
Quite a moment, yeah.
Yeah. And after 3 years, I went to work for WNOX Radio, great rock and roll radio station. And it was, I mean, we were a great rock and roll radio station.
There's your fun kicking back in, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm still trying to figure out what I'm going to be when I grow up. It was really funny. I would register for school, my classes, and I'd get halfway through and realize I was so far behind I didn't have a prayer. So I'd drop out, right, and come back the next quarter and register again. But because I thought I was a part-time guy. You know, but I kept working 48 hours a week and no time to study. And so eventually I decided this is really silly. And besides, I was having such a good time driving my Austin Healey, wearing my Beetle boots, long duct tail sweeper back, emceeing all those rock and roll shows. Yeah. You know, it was really fun. And I got a call from a guy who had been a newsman with us, had moved, Roger Barre, who wound up at CNN. And had a really good job. But I'd gone down to Mobile, Alabama. WALA-TV was a television station that had been crippled by a strike and had been purchased by WDSU folks out of New Orleans. Great, great operators. They had moved into a theater building downtown by the waterfront on Government Street. And I thought, well, I'll go off and grow up and be a television person. So it was a great place to work, Jack, because they were really essentially recreating the station. And I could do anything I wanted to do if I could convince the management it was a good idea. So I was their television weatherman. I was host for the Mardi Gras parades. As a matter of fact, the first assignment I got when I got there, the program director, great fellow named Claude Evans, good teacher, gentleman, handed me a book and said, okay, you are the host and producer for our Mardi Gras coverage. 3 weeks worth of parades and balls and all that stuff.
Wow.
Talk about over your head. So it was fun. I had a great time doing that. It was a great learning experience, but we were a little too far from home. So those weekend trips home to grandparents, right? So after 3 years, I saw a trade publication our chief engineer brought to me. And Grady said, Wayne, you want to read this. It's about WHAS television.
This is why you're in Mobile.
Uh-huh. And I'd applied to WHAS and WAVE, WSM in, not WSM, but W, the yeah, Memphis.
Oh, Memphis, yeah.
Yeah.
WSM, no, yeah, that's whatever it was, yeah.
Yeah. It was a Chris Howard station. I'd worked for a Chris Howard station in Knoxville. So, anyway. It was an interview in this technical journal with Sam Gifford about the WHAS Crusade for Children. And I said, that's where I want to work. So I wrote Sam a letter and said, listen, I'm really wonderful. And if you need somebody, please call me.
Sure, you've had all that experience with
right. Now, meantime, Bob Morris is our news director. And Bob, I almost didn't get to WHAS
Bobby's in Mobile.
Bob was our news director in Mobile. I was the weather guy. The Binghams were undergoing some transformation with the television stations. And give me a minute. Dot Ridings and Don Ridings and Bob had known each other in Charlotte, North Carolina, where Bob was the state reporter for WSSC Television. Don Ridings was working for the Charlotte Observer, and they became very good friends and commuted back and forth together. So Bob comes to WALA-TV as the news director, and Don Ridings and Dot move to Louisville, where he becomes, as far as I know, the first environmental reporter for the Courier-Journal.
Yep.
Right. So one day, Don calls Bob and says, listen, they're redoing WHAS top to bottom, and they're restructuring the management, and you need to apply for this job. You're going to love these people. So Bob applies for the news director's job, and by gosh, gets it. Well, my wife is really upset because he's like, you know, that's where we want to be.
Right, yeah.
Well, one day they were in the process of moving from the 6th and 7th floors of the Courier-Journal building down to the new building.
Yes, on Chestnut Street.
On Chestnut, right. And everything's in a state of flux, and things are lost, and things are moving over. And Hugh Barr, who's the new radio program director, walks down the hall to the other corner to Bob's office and said, you know, I got an application and an air check from a guy I think you worked with in Mobile, Alabama, and I cannot find it anywhere. Bob calls and said, Perky, you better call. So I called Hugh, and I said, listen, I can come to Louisville in August. And I did. And
That's how that started?
I almost got lost in the shuffle.
Well, now your original application from that magazine ad, was that for Sam Gifford in television?
Yes, and he passed it on.
Oh, that's how it wound up in Hugh Barr's hands.
Yes.
I see. Wow. Well, now that was what year was that, Wayne? You came to
Louisville? 1969.
1969. And it was undergoing, and Hugh Barr was a big mover behind that. Talk about what WHAS radio was doing at that time, pre-you and pre-Hugh Barr, and what Hugh had in mind, and you were a big part of that. You were kind of the key player in that. He was looking for somebody to start that chain of events, I believe.
That's sort of the way it happened.
First of all, what was WHAS radio doing when you got there?
We were sort of a middle-of-the-road, nondescript, hard to put your finger on. Yep. The guys who were doing it were really good at what they did, but they were about 10 years past.
And there was no constant theme all through the day, I don't think, was there?
There was not. It was kind of block
programming. So what were they doing mornings? What were they doing mornings?
Jim Walton was playing a little music and news, and Paul Clark was the voice of God and the newsman in the morning.
Yes,
but
yes.
At that point, people typically listened to WHAS in the morning at 7 o'clock for Paul Clark's news, and at noon to see what was going on.
At a farm report then.
Yes, and there was a 5 o'clock block of news, and Milton Metz did the stock report there.
5 in the afternoon.
Kaywood Ledford did a 10-minute sports cast that just sang. Mm-hmm. And then they listened for UK basketball. And sometimes football.
So the radio station itself was not necessarily a prime mover in the market at that time. The wave radio, Wacky people. No, Wacky was Wacky going in?
Yep.
Yeah, Wacky
this was a great radio town.
Yeah.
And Wacky and KLO fighting each other's.
Yes, and some great people came through there.
Yes, sir. It was and people broke records here. I mean, it was a really important radio town. There was a guy named Bucks Braun who was the country programmer for Wind Radio, which was a nationally prominent country music station. There was a fellow named Jim Lucas who had grown up here and gone off to New York and was the opening act for The Tonight Show, who decided he didn't like living in New York or whatever, and he came back, and he was doing 9 to noon on WAVE radio, and then I think doing some television things for them. So he was like me, a hybrid, you know, he got to do both of those. But WHAS, it was important. I tell you a story. When I came to interview, and Bob Morse walked me from 6th and Chestnut down to 6th and Broadway to go through my test. Did you have to go through those tests?
Oh, yes, yes,
yeah.
Yes.
They want to know if you could be a typesetter.
Yes.
Things that didn't
run. Yeah, because WHS was one of the Binghams, and they had the Courier Journal and Standard Reviewer and Radio and Television. Yeah.
So as we're walking from one end to the other, and we pass a Standard Reviewer in the middle, Bob said to me, that's where they print the money, in the basement. Some guy who worked for the Standard Reviewer had created that offset, that Standard Reviewer process, and they were printing Sunday supplements for 120 newspapers. Yeah. You remember on Thursday and Friday afternoons, those
Parade
big semis
magazine,
would back up, and they load them and send them all over America. Yeah. So,
and that was all the Bingham Corporation there.
Yeah. So it wasn't important that the broadcast properties make money. So we had a classical music radio station that was, and all the sales guys were on commission. Not on commission, but on salary, so they didn't have to really hustle because they were getting paid. It wasn't important that the broadcast properties make any money. And one day, Cy McKinnon, who was the business manager for the Bingham Enterprises, walked into Barry Sr. and Jr. and said, you know, there's a great movement in America. This is a really ironic story. There's a great movement in Congress right now, concern about dissemination of information and too much being concentrated in the hands of one entity. For example, Mr. Bingham, you own newspapers, two of them. You have three broadcast properties, and it may be deemed that that's not a good idea. And you may have to sell those broadcast properties. And if you do, you're going to take a bath because they're not profitable. And that's when all the...
was the catalyst for it.
Yeah, that started everything around.
Now, how long had Hugh Barr been there when all this
began? Less than a year, I think, when I came.
Was he called in for that purpose?
Yes.
Okay, that's fine.
They restructured everything. Vic Scholes was the general manager. He was moved aside, and they began to look for his replacement.
And who replaced him, do you recall?
Eventually Ed Shadburn came over.
Fine operator, yes.
From Channel 32.
Yeah.
The news director and the new news director was Bob Morse. The new television program director was Dick Sweeney, who was moved up to succeed Sam Gifford, who moved over to become the general manager of a new production company called Graphic 11.
Mm-hmm.
And Hugh was brought in from Salt Lake City to be the new radio program director.
So that was all coming together then when you showed up there. Yeah.
Now, what was interesting about that was the Binghams were pretty smart. And Morse and I had been good friends. So when I came here without my wife and family, I spent the first couple of months living in his basement. He had a room down there that they had built for his mother, who came occasionally in their house, and I stayed with him. And he told me the story that they had decided to let, where we went long, am I going way too long?
No, you're fine, you're great. We've got plenty of space.
Okay.
I'm just checking the levels.
They decided that they would let the new assistant station managers, you know, like Barr and Morse and Sweeney, interview the prospective general manager. So these guys were coming in from across the country. They had about five of them. And each of these department heads would take the new prospective general managers out to dinner. They'd interview them, right? And what was funny about it is they didn't hire any of those guys. They brought Ed Shadburn over from Channel 32.
That's wild.
Isn't that funny?
It is.
So there was a legend, on in the mornings. Jim Walton had been doing mornings forever. Walton calling and all those. Those guys were so good. Van Vance had, there was a staff of guys there who had been there forever. Paul Clark was our senior announcer, and what a gentle guy he was. What a wonderful man he was. Paul had been there for a very long time, but there was Bill Britton and Milton Metz and
Tom Brooks.
Brooks, thank you. And Ray Shelton and Bill Britton. And then Van Vance had been there 10 years, and he was the youngest guy on the staff.
So you're the new kid coming in then,
after Jerry David Malloy.
Jerry
had been there 3 years, and then me.
Okay.
So I really...
Now, what was Jerry doing? Jerry was just doing like general...
He was an announcer. He did a show from 9 to noon. By that time, Hugh had restructured things a little bit. Van Vance was doing an afternoon show from 3 to 7, and... Jerry David was on from 9 to noon. Jim Walton opened up in the morning, and I don't remember who was in the middle of the day. It might have been I'm not sure. But it was decided that Jim would become, he had been the host and MC for the Crusade for Children for all those years, and 17, I guess. So he would become the new executive director of the Crusade for Children. And Jerry David became the morning guy, and I did noon to three.
Oh, really?
Yeah, for about 3 months, which was a gift to me.
Sure.
Because I didn't have to be the guy. You remember that?
No pressure on you.
Joe B. Hall used to say, or maybe Kaywood said about Joe B., I don't want to be the guy who replaces I don't want to be the guy who replaces Adolph Rupp. Yeah. I want to be the guy who replaces the guy who replaces Adolph Rupp, right? So I had that buffer in the middle. And, you know, I was a fast-talking, high-energy kind of morning guy, and there were a lot of phone calls saying, send that guy back to Wacky Radio.
Is that right?
Yeah. I was asking engineers to do things that we used to do in rock and roll radio that they didn't do.
So you asked engineers, were they running your equipment at that time?
Yes.
So where was your studio at that time?
In the middle of the building.
That was the one in the middle there. And so they sat on one side with the controls. You sat on the other side of the glass with
it. With a desk, a microphone, a cough switch, you know, so I could turn just enough to, they control the microphone. Yeah. But I could turn it off along to take a breath.
So you had to have some cooperation from them to get all this stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. And my headset, and a pencil, and a telephone. And they were in charge.
Do you remember who some of the engineer who was the engineer on your show? Do you remember?
Paul DeArmond.
Harold DeArmond.
Harold DeArmond. Butch Toon.
Yeah, I remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, two really good guys.
Yeah,
Butch was particularly into what we were doing. He was a fun guy.
So they were cooperative with you. They weren't putting up roadblocks all along. They came around, is what you're saying.
Yes, right. Yeah, they raised. They raised eyebrows.
How long before you began to run your own equipment?
Well, it was kind of interesting. I was essentially, Hugh and I agreed that I would come to work in August. And I didn't get here till November the 10th because they were building a studio that we could operate ourselves.
Ah.
But they had to go through contract negotiations with the engineers to get the permission to let us.
Sure, that's right. The engineers' union, that was in their contract to run that equipment. You weren't allowed to run the equipment, were you?
That's exactly right.
Even production things.
That's right.
Yeah, okay. You would come in and voice it, and they would put everything together.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Wow. So it took until March for that to happen. And so I became the morning guy in March of 1970.
How about that?
Yeah.
Wow. And that was kind of the start. You know, when I came to town in 1973, you guys had things going pretty good. But I think I remember that they used to talk about how WHAS was referred around town as the sleeping giant at this 50,000-watt station. And if they ever woke up, and you guys were in the process of waking them up.
We were trying.
To become the cuddly giant.
That's exactly right. I was talking. I was out 3-4 nights a week on weekends. I figured if I could meet an audience of 25 people and get three of them to turn me on tomorrow morning and they liked what they heard, I had three new
listeners. Let's talk about that just a minute, because that, to me, that was one of the key ingredients of your success. Was that something, so you had thought that out. Was that kind of one of your philosophies of, or was that
one of those things that evolved?
Shape up?
Yeah, everything just kind of evolved. Mm-hmm. I remember vividly the day Hugh called me into his office. Now, we didn't subscribe to the rating systems because we were above that.
Sure. Yeah.
But there was always a salesman with a buddy in an agency somewhere who did subscribe who could get us a pirated copy.
Now, talk about the rating systems. What was a rating system? What was that?
That's ARB and
they
Pulse.
Were used for what purpose?
To determine the size of your audience.
And the sales guys.
And the demographics of those audiences.
But WHS didn't do that because they weren't interested in making money up to... Right.
We were above
that. That's what you mean by above that. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. So I remember vividly the day that Hugh walked into his office for our semi-annual look at the ratings, and I sat down across his desk from him.
And this is in 1970 again, still?
It's probably about the time you got there, in about 1973, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I sat down across from him, and he opened up the book, and he said, come over here and look, let me show you this. And I said, Hugh, you've never let me look at these numbers before. And he looked me back and laughed and said, if I had, it would have broken your heart.
Let me digress just a second. Tell me a little bit about Hugh Barr, because he was kind of the genius behind carving out what became the cuddly giant, wasn't he? Was he?
There was an afternoon guy who came in after me named Jeff Douglas.
Oh, yeah.
Remember Jeffy?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Who nicknamed us the cuddly giant.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Jeffy was our promotion
guy. But I mean, as far as program is concerned, getting the elements and getting the news department and having sports departments, that was kind of Hughes architecture, wasn't it?
It truly was.
What kind of guy was he? What was he like?
He was one of the easiest guys to work for I've ever met. He was, I wouldn't say demanding, but encouraging. His memos were a little flowery, and for those who didn't like change, often invoked some ridicule, you know, some teasing about Hugh and his language. But he was a bright, positive, upbeat guy who really believed that we could be really, really good.
That was the key. Yeah. I always had the impression that he always knew where we were going. He wasn't just managing. He always knew what the next step was going to be and the step after that and where it was going.
I think he was a terrific architect.
Yeah.
I believe you're right about that. I think he had the vision, and we were just in the trenches trying to slog through the mud.
He was directing it all.
Yeah.
So you looked at the ratings. What were they like? Were they positive?
Well, they were, up to then, it had been up a little here and up a little there and lost a little here and lost a little that, you know. He was an interesting guy. I'll tell you what kind of guy he was. I'm one of those people that probably is terribly difficult to manage. I would go in his office, and we would play an air check, a tape of my show. And he would point out something to me that I had done and would suggest to me a different way. And I would need to explain it to him, why I had done, what I'd done, and, you know. And then if he didn't get it after the third time, I'd say, okay, I'll do it.
He had the patience to let that process
happen. He did. Yeah. He was very patient with me.
Very interesting.
Yeah. I loved the radio station. I remember that the first summer I was there, in August of 70, his wife Maureen and I went out to the fairgrounds for the Kentucky State Fair, and we set up our booth. We were buried in the bowels of the East Wing. We had nothing but a desk and a curtain backdrop. She and I were there, and we're giving away a big, giant screen color TV. Sweaty, hot. It was just
not air conditioned.
Oh, not air conditioned.
And it was probably a sawdust floor or something too, I think, wasn't it?
At least
you hope it was sawdust.
It was mostly in the East Wing. It was all displays and things. It was concrete. You know, it was a cement floor. But we're there and sweating, and the State Fair sort of became a part of us. You know, so the next year he managed to negotiate and get us moved in closer to the door, so we got some air conditioning coming out of the arena, and it was a little cooler. About the third year we were out there, I got a visit from a guy from Henry County. The Henry County JCETs had always sponsored the Miss Henry County Fair pageant, and they held it, planned to hold it, in the horseshoe ring at the state fair, at the county fair. And I got a call one day from a lady in 1970, I guess, saying, would you come up and be our MC? So I went up to MC the Miss Henry County Fair pageant, and it looked like it was going to rain. So we moved the pageant to the high school auditorium. There was a Presbyterian minister there, Steve, last name's gone, who became a good friend. I introduced him, and he did the invocation, and Jack, just as he said, amen, there was this enormous crack of thunder and the lightning, and the lights all went out for about 20 minutes. I teased him hard about it. The next year, we went on the pageant, and it was a lovely evening. And then the next summer, I got a call from Betty again, so would you come up and MC? And so I went up. And we started to hold it in the outdoor arena, but it looked threatening, so moved again to the high school auditorium, and had a great evening. It was terrific. The first year, it rained so hard that they had to lead me out the back roads because the roads are all flooded. It was a terribly, terribly hard rain. So later that summer, I'm working the fair booth at the Kentucky State Fair, and a fella comes up and says, hey, Wayne, how you doing? Doing fine. How about you? So, okay, when are you coming back up to Henry County? And I said, well, I'm not sure. Why do you ask? He said, well, it's getting mighty dry.
We need rain.
Yeah. As you know, people become your best friends.
That's right.
You know?
Well, that was part of the that was part of your community involvement. You went out and you did that, and you were sincere about that. You enjoyed people,
yep,
and that was part of it. So
yeah, it was fun.
So you did a lot of those kind of things, didn't you? Emceeing pageants, speaking at different civic organizations and things like that.
Yeah, gosh, I have no idea how many.
Oh,
I was out 3-4 times. Yeah, yeah. I got a call. I learned some important lessons. I got a call one day from the fellow who owned the Coca-Cola Bottling Company and happened to be an angel for the Kentucky Junior Miss Pageant. They held it at the auditorium at Spalding. And he said, we need an MC. Would you come visit me? I want to meet you. So I went to see him. And he wanted to check me out, make sure I was an okay guy. It turned out they were looking for an MC because the fellow who had been traditionally their MC for years, another television personality in the market, had been handed the envelopes at the end of the pageant when it was time to announce the winners at the year before, and somehow the information got all confused. Now, you'll appreciate that, being there on the stage, live in front of all those peoples, all those mommies and daddies, you know. There's only one family out that's going to come out really happy after that evening, and all the others are not going to be really happy, and you're the MC. Somehow the information got confused. It got all messed up, and he said, that's it. I'm not doing this anymore. So the lesson I learned was you've got to be able to go with the flow, you know. In that situation, like doing the morning show or anything else, you have to be prepared for things to not turn out right. And the question is, what do you do when it doesn't work?
Interesting.
Yeah. What do you do when the hard part comes, you know?
Was there anything you could do to prepare for that? Or
I think you just have to be prepared. For example, I'm emceeing, we're at the auditorium, and I'm emceeing the finals. Saturday night, the finals are performing for the Kentucky Junior Miss Pageant. It's about the third or fourth year I've done it. And I had introduced the performer. She's on stage and doing her number, her act. And I'm over on the side with Jim Smith, the producer, and we're talking about what's going to happen between her and the next girl and how I'm going to fill, how much time do I need to fill, what do I need to do to get her off and them on. When the music stopped, I thought, holy smoke. And I dashed on stage only to realize that she was doing a two-part performance. Right? And I'm now out in the middle of the stage. I said, look, we're all friends here, right? We're all just going to pretend that this never happened. And I snuck off the stage.
And we're invited back next year.
That's,
sure. That's great. That's great. That's going with the flow. That's for sure.
Right. You know, it took us a while to get going.
We find all the right elements and everything.
Yes, I think.
Well, let's talk about that just for a second.
Who did you replace when you came in?
I think there was a fellow named Dave McCree, I believe, that I replaced.
He had been our first all-night guy.
Is it? Yeah, and then I think they moved him to middays.
I think,
and I'm not sure that was.
Yes.
He was happy about that. I'm not sure, but anyway.
And he wound up going off to Little Rock, I believe.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But so. I came in 1973. You guys had wound it up before that. It was really starting to get into gear about that time. So you were on mornings.
I tell you what nailed us. What happened to us was April 3rd.
Oh, the tornado, yeah. 1974, yeah.
That's right.
Talk about that.
When that happened, I think we became the go-to radio station because it became our
full-time. Let's remember that phrase. I want to go back to that. Go ahead. The tornado, I'm going to talk about go-to in just a minute. Let's talk some more about the tornado, though, and your experience with that.
I think that,
That was a major, major thing.
Yeah.
I remember that, of course, Dick Gilbert.
Right, followed it.
Yeah, but you had to come in the next morning.
Right.
And kind of recap everything. You spent the night at the radio station, I'm sure, didn't you?
No, actually, I didn't. I was listening to Dick on the air with Jeffy.
But you had to come
in
the next
morning. In my basement.
Yeah,
but I had to come in the next morning.
And tie all that together.
Yeah, get the thing going.
That had to be a strange
thing. A lot of that was just a blur. I mean, it was just like full-time, wall-to-wall. All we did was talk about what was going on and how we were going to solve this problem and what we were going to do with it, you know. Gilbert was amazing. I remember vividly, I think it was Chuck Paddock was on the air with the meteorologist at the Stanford Field at the weather station. when he said, oh, there it is, I'm gone, and dove under his desk, you know. Gilbert dropped down and followed it all across the county. He wound up getting a presidential citation from President Nixon.
I remember I was on the air until 3:30.
Okay.
And that's just before it hit. But we'd had warnings every 5 minutes. Of course, it hit Breckinridge County and Brandenburg and all that.
Right.
And you still don't think it's going to hit you, you know.
Yeah.
But and then Jeff came on after me, and he and Dick were just great. And I remember Dick saying, they're talking about our target. Whoops, there it is. And he spotted it over Freedom Hall.
Yeah. And there goes the horse barn.
That's right, yeah. I remember him saying, too, he flew over Cherokee Park. And he said, ladies and gentlemen, Cherokee Park,
wow,
there's no more. And I thought, Dick, don't be so dramatic here. He was right.
Yeah.
He had a different view than I did. Yeah, that was a very strange time. Yeah.
Isn't it remarkable that it's 30? We're still emotional about it. Yeah.
But, you know, you're right. That was the mark when it really kind of became the cuddly giant.
Yeah, it did.
Came the go-to. Let's talk about the go-to. I want to talk about that again for a minute here because... And you were a big part of that because whenever there was a major event in town or out of town, Final Four,
yeah,
the station was there, and you did your shows from there. It was the go. If you wanted to find information, that's where you went. That was always my impression.
Yeah,
not only information but entertainment and just being in the thick of things.
We intended to be.
How did that happen? Was that something?
Yes, absolutely. We look for opportunities. How can we be the go-to radio station?
Yeah,
and I think that. I think maybe we just had, we were young enough and brash enough to be able to pull it. I ran into Julian Carroll about 3 or 4 years ago, and I told him that he was the last governor I could call at 7 o'clock in the morning who would answer his own phone.
And you did that.
Yes, and we were able to do that. They would take our phone calls and frequently would answer questions, you know.
How did that happen? I mean, you were on. Was that come from your community involvement and being involved in things, or and I guess then by that point the reputation of the radio station. But you had that ability. If there was some major event happening or a decision to be made, you're on the phone with the mayor or the governor, and you're on a first name basis with these people. How did all that happen?
Well, I called them Mister.
Well, called about your nickname, sir.
Yes. Thank you and please. Right. Well, it was a conscious effort, though, to be the go-to radio station. If there was a question, let's get an answer.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know, we had Glenn Baston, who was hustling really hard back in the newsroom, and then Brian Rublin joined him. And they built a solid news organization.
Well, they did. You remember some of the people that went through there?
Chuck Paddock and Byron Crawford, you know.
Dan Burgess.
Mike Edgerly, who's now running public radio up in Minnesota.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Remember Dan Burgess? And they also brought in some outstanding female broadcasters. Yeah. Mary Jeffries, Mary McCarthy, many, many others.
Who won wonderful awards. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Brian Rublin was a great teacher, I think. He could find talent. He and Hugh, I think they had that in common. They could find good talent and really groom them.
He was the news director there.
Yes, and won tons of awards. I mean, we were a highly respected newsroom.
Although Glenn was the first news director in that genre. I mean, he was not the first news director, but kind of that team that Hugh was putting together to carve out a news department. That was my impression anyway. Is that correct?
He came in just before me, I think, and he was the radio news reporter in the morning, or news director. He fed Paul Clark.
I see.
Yeah, and then they hired another one and another one. But until then, the radio, television, news, everybody was one.
One, right.
Yeah. All the announcers worked for radio and TV.
Yeah.
All the news guys worked for radio and TV. So that it was a great pleasure the morning after the election to have Bob Johnson, who knew everybody and knew everything, come in and sit down with me and just talk about the elections.
Yeah.
That's not something that had been done. We became more free form, I think, Jack, although we thought we worked by a pretty rigid formula. Here's the deal. We had a very rigid format, but we could throw it out the window if there was an opportunity to seize upon.
You were talk radio before it was talk radio, but you talked when you had something to say.
Yes.
Otherwise,
we played a little music.
And that expanded more, though, as it became more and more. It became more important as a center of activity and information, that talk The morning show especially became even more important.
One of the things that was important about Louisville is that FM radio was slow to penetrate. There were great radio stations here, and so FM was slow to be born. I think the alternate rock had begun, but had not really caught on. Public radio had yet to be really born. So it was AM radio. We were what was important at that time. Now, I was headed in a pretty important direction with that.
Okay. Well, the fact that we were information at that point, you know, you were...
Well, we weren't really sure what we were at that time.
It was evolving.
Yeah.
Evolving positively, though. That was good.
Yeah.
But let's go back to the events. You were always at any event that was happening, Brother Here, or if something was happening out of town that involved a Louisville team or a newsmaker or something.
I tell you what kind of guy Hugh Barr was. The Bingham companies always provided a team of employees to work for the United Way campaign. I remember the first United Way campaign kickoff luncheon I attended at the old Kentucky Hotel, and the featured speaker was Lee Corso, the University of Louisville football coach at that time. And when Lee stood up to speak, he said, I knew I wanted to be the guest speaker for this luncheon when I discovered, and I was told that attending would be all the movers and shakers and government leaders in the community and housewives soliciting in the East End. Because in those days, we used to see people knocking door to door. Well, today you couldn't get away with that line, but in that day it brought down the house. So I'm the captain because, you know, you get together with the team and they point to somebody. I'm the captain of the team. So I get off the air at 9 o'clock in the morning, and we meet out at that old restaurant that's no longer there on Brownsboro Road that was a community neighborhood institution. I didn't think of Bowers.
Bowers.
Yeah. We meet for coffee at Bowers and then talk about our plans for the day, and we go out. One day, there was a fellow from the Courier-Journal, a reporter, who was on my team, who said, Wayne, I'm having a real problem with this house. It's in Indian Hills, and it's on the street, and I know there's somebody home, but nobody answered the door. And I said, well, let's go. And of course, they're teasing me about people recognizing me.
Sure.
There's Perky, the guy in the morning, right? And so we drive up to the house, he and I, and pull it into the driveway. And as we walk across the front yard on the sidewalk to the front door, I realized that there's somebody in the house because she's walking in front of the window. So I walk up and knock on the front door, and there's no answer. And I knock again, and there's no answer. And I rap the third time, and the window beside the door opens a crack. And I hear a woman's voice say, what do you want? And I said, hi, I'm Wayne Perky, and this is Harry Smith, and we're from the United Way campaign. And she says, we don't need any help, and slammed the window. The point is that we were out doing things.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I was out emceeing something or snipping some ribbons, but do you remember the first fall we had, no, you weren't there yet. We had Jeffy's birthday party at the brand new Oxmoor Center. Yes. We had Jeffy's birthday party right there in the big open concourse. And nobody came. Jeffy dressed in, I think his birthday was in April, so he dressed in a an Easter Bunny suit.
I've seen pictures of that.
And because nobody, you know, we weren't that kind of radio station you know.
Well, let's talk about the lineup again. You were on mornings. Did Jerry David begin to do 9 to noon?
Then yes,
Jerry David Malloy.
Yes.
And then probably until I came, I think Dave, I don't know who did noon to 3. And then Jeff Douglas was doing afternoons, though, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Actually,
and that was a new venture, too, because...
That happened because Van Vance, who had been on noon from 3 to 7, moved over to the sports department because we got Kentucky Colonels basketball.
Oh, yeah.
And he became the play-by-play guy.
Yeah.
For, you know, his first love, anyway, was sports.
Now, was Jeff already there at that time?
He had come in, and he came in like May or June to replace Van.
Okay. And he was bringing a new element to the radio station. An afternoon that was, he was trying to be funny and
He wrote a little book. and he did kinds of skits and things.
He had characters on and things like that, And that was a...
He had a woman named Charlie, remember?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Who would call him with and make outrageous statements.
And I think that just started with her calling, and then it developed
she
into
had
a shtick.
Terrific radio voice.
And, yeah,
became a character in the show.
She was a character voice, And, you know...
And people kind of did that, you know. There was a guy named Stu who listened to me in the mornings, every morning, down in the south end of town and driving in. And then one day we hired a new afternoon guy, and I don't remember if it was you or Pete Sullivan, but he was thrilled to death we had a new afternoon guy. And he said to me, he hasn't heard any of my stuff, Perky. You've heard all my stuff. I've got a new audience.
New audience. That's funny. That is funny. That is an element that WHAS had. You were connected to the listeners. That listener line was always open. And we had some of our best material from that.
Absolutely.
Not only information, but best material.
We tried to become as close to a two-way radio station as you could possibly be.
Yeah.
There was a fellow who got one of the first people I knew who had a cell phone in his car, who would call me almost every morning on his way up I-65 from Bullitt County to tell me what was going on. Gilbert couldn't be everywhere.
Sure.
He couldn't see everything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it made him a part of the radio station, you know? So I'll run into him at a U of L basketball game, for example, and say, hey, Wayne, still got my cell phone working. But those guys don't take my calls.
How about that? That's great. Actually, this is a sidebar, but while you were doing that, I was on from, 9 to noon, and of course the helicopter was gone by that time, and we didn't have traffic reports. So I had a fellow start calling me, but I had another guy said, well, I don't have a cell phone yet. I'm going to send you a postcard report. So he would say, last Wednesday on the waters of this. But it was that kind of station where you would do those. As I said, your best material many times came from listeners.
That's right.
And also information. I remember when the plane, Indiana National Guard plane crashed in Evansville.
Yeah,
I was on the air and somebody called and said, do you guys have a report of a plane crash in Evansville? I said, we haven't heard anything yet. Let me call the newsroom. And the newsroom called and the plane had just crashed in Evansville, killing the people. So it was that kind of a station, though, is what I'm saying. We were connected to the community and...
And they became our eyes and ears.
Exactly right.
You know?
Yeah. Well, that was fun, too.
It was fun.
So what was happening at night at that time? Let's see, you had a sports talk program on, I guess, then, and then Milton. At that time, Milton was on from 9 to midnight.
I don't think we had sports talk yet.
Oh, you didn't? No.
I don't think so. I think
Did Milton didn't go come on early and go for a long time? Or
Milton kind of floated around. He was on from...
This is Milton Metz, of course.
7 to 9, and then moved to 8 to 10, and then 9 to... he kind of floated around in there. And then when Van had moved to sports... eventually, he became the sports guy. We did Van Van Sports Talk from 7 till 9.
Right, that's right,
And then Milt from 9 to mid 11. It was really funny. In the early days, I remember listening to Metz one night. My son loved Milton. And I remember listening to Milton, and I thought I heard a voice I recognized. So her name was, I think, Harriet or something. She said, hey, Milton, this is Harriet. And what I discovered the next day when I asked Milton about it was that just in case, there were people on staff who were assigned to call in if there was dead air. And it was Mimi, who was really as smart as a tack, you know, and always had good things to say. But it was funny. But, you know... Pretty soon, that was not a problem. Pretty soon, there was a waiting list.
No question.
Yeah, you could get it.
Great
absolutely.
Program. Forerunner.
Forerunner. Absolutely.
Well, now, Wayne, you had a...
But let me tell you one more story about Milton.
Go.
Okay. Jeffy, who was always looking for things outside the box and new wrinkles to add and things to do, decided Milton was going on vacation, and he decided would it be a great idea if each of us did Milton's show one night while he was gone. We would guest host Milton's show. So I'm thinking about doing a talk radio show and following Milton Metz, and how would I not embarrass myself? And I thought, well, I'll talk about something innocuous like our collegiate sports becoming too professional. I'm on the air for about 20 minutes, and I get a call from a lady who was just really, really angry with me. She said, I cannot believe this. In a mere 20 minutes, you have completely destroyed everything Milton has worked 15 years to build.
No way.
I was not invited to host again.
You know, I recall something, though. I thought this was a nice touch. There were many years when you would go on vacation, And you would have a guest host, but they'd be the mayor,
yeah,
the county judge. You'd have some celebrity in there. How did you pull that off?
It was just one of those ideas. Wouldn't it be a good idea? What would you think about? And so I'm copying, but people always would say, yeah, we'll come up and do a morning. Yeah. As a matter of fact, one year I invited Colonel Sanders to come host the show. And the call back from his office was, he can't come that week, but could he come another time? So the week after I came back, he came in and visited with me one morning. Yes. Well, you know how you do those things. You just kind of punch the button. Good morning, it's WHAS Radio. We're on the air with the Colonel. Wayne! I heard this voice say, I can't turn off the hot water! And it was my wife. I had changed the faucet in the kitchen sink the night before and apparently hadn't done it really well. But what was funny was looking over at Colonel Sanders, who said, oh, now, dear, calm down. It's going to be all right. If you'll just go down in the basement, you'll find a cutoff switch.
This is the Colonel in his white suit, his bow tie, and his goatee. He's giving plumbing advice. Those are rare moments indeed, for sure. That was great. That was great.
Where were you going?
Well, I'm just talking about your guest host that you had there. You had a lot of people like that. I didn't remember the colonel. I didn't remember that. I remember the you had...
Well, the mayor was always easy. Yeah. And Denny Crum would usually come.
That's right.
Could get one of the colonels to come in and do something, you know. Oh. Yeah.
And didn't have to worry about somebody taking over your slot because they read a few and they came back. Hey, get this guy back in here. That was good. So.
And none of them wanted to come in at 5.
They do
7 to 9.
Yeah, you were on 5 to 9.
Well, we kind of floated. There was a time when we were short of folks. Maybe it was when you left, when I went from 5 till 10. I started out from 6 till 9. And then from 6:30. Barney Arnold was on from 6 to 6:30 initially. And so I come on at 6:30 and go to 9. And then Barney was moved back.
Barney was the farm director, was giving farm reports. He was a legend there also.
Absolutely. Yeah, right. And absolutely, he was a legend. Boy, he logged 1,000 miles, I bet, a year, visiting folks and doing talks. I once said to him, Barney, how do you ever get accustomed to doing these evening appearances and then coming in early in the morning? And he said, you never get used to it. It's just a part of it. Because
you did that all
people
the
live on their own schedules, and you have to adjust to their schedule.
Well, that was a problem for you, because many of the things you did were in the evening.
Yeah.
Had to be there early the next morning,
So I learned that I'd been sleep-deprived for 30 years. So for the first 6 months I was retired, I slept a lot.
You enjoyed it. I ended up catching up.
That's right.
Let's talk about the physical stuff for just a minute. When you came, the station by that time had moved from the Courier Journal building at 6th and Broadway up to the new WHA on 520 West Chestnut.
Yeah,
6th and Chestnut. Yeah, mm-hmm. What was that like? Was it you didn't operate at all in the old place? Did you?
That's right.
Part of the new place.
Yeah.
But you still went to the Courier Journal for your personnel stuff and your tests and all that.
Yeah. Sort of thing. Yeah. But actually, didn't frequent it much. I wasn't down there much.
Yeah.
So I really didn't know those people a lot. It had been a big sort of a happy family before. And the folks had been there for a long time.
But everybody was starting to carve out.
But we all became us and them, you know.
So physically, when once things were rolling, you're doing the morning show. You had a control board. You operated it. And, newsman. Where was the news? The news people would come in. Were they across from
the desk? Right room? Across the room.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You operated your own equipment.
Yeah.
Had you? Of course, you'd done that in the past. That was not a problem for you.
That's right.
Although I would think it was difficult to do all that, prepare for all the commercials, and still keep your mind on what you're doing, and stay in the flow of things.
And so apparently, I would sometimes misread the clock. Just unconsciously, and somebody would say, "No, it's not 8:10; it's 6:10 or whatever."
Moved around several studios in there from the time you were there. A lot of different studios in the building, I think.
Right. There was another story I was going to share with you.
Huh.
We were there for a long time,
How long did you do the morning show, Wayne? You did
30 years.
30 years. Yeah.
Yeah, 30. Actually, not quite 30, but pretty darn close.
And top rated most of those. That's just remarkable.
Well, it's one of those inertia things, I believe, Jack. It took us 5 years to get there.
Yeah.
And once we got there, we were there.
Yeah.
We were.
That's a remarkable record in any market, really.
I think.
Because you had a lot of competition. There were some strong radio stations here in this town.
Yes, there were. It was a great radio market. Really good radio market. Yeah. But I had a great team. I always had a great team. And I always thought that my job, I said this many times, my main talent was pitching softballs to guys like Dick Gilbert and Ken Schultz, letting them hit it out of the park.
So who were the ingredients you had? So you had Gilbert did the traffic.
Yep, but when we were making it up.
Yeah.
Van had a guy on, some kind of a Wally somebody, that Hugh had found somewhere, a comedian, because we didn't have all that. Oh. You know, Wave TV and radio had Dick Tong in the helicopter, and we didn't have a helicopter. Yeah. So for a little while, we worked with the police department. We had a couple of policemen who would come on with me a couple of times during the hour and do traffic reports. Sergeant Dick, what's his last name? I've forgotten. Mm-hmm. We had Pinpoint Weather that would call. I think they were in Cleveland. A couple of really funny guys.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Pinpoint Weather.
And I remember that one morning, I'm on the air. It's about 5:45 in the morning, and the studio door opens. We're now in the studio where you are.
Mm-hmm.
The studio door opens, and Glenn Bastion walks in and says, "Wayne, I'd like to introduce you to your new meteorologist, Ken Schultz." And I went ballistic. "You're hiring somebody without checking with me first? What?" Who turned out to be one of the greatest gifts I ever got.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he was very good.
Ken was so funny.
So when you were really up and rolling, you had Dick Gilbert on the helicopter traffic reports, Ken Schultz, meteorologist. Was Brian your newsman, Brian Rublin? Although they rotated around, really.
Yeah. Well, actually, Rublin had been my morning guy. Then he went over for a short time to Wave.
Oh, that's right.
Remember,
yeah.
And then came back. Bastion went to another radio station to be the news director. They were trying to build a news department. And so Brian came back and was our morning guy and a morning anchor guy. And that's when his career, I think, really, really took off. Because he began to hire people like Mary Jeffries.
Yeah, yeah. You know. Strong team. Yeah. Who was, do you have a sports guy? Who did the sports in the morning?
I had several. Bud Reeves was there for a time, remember?
Yeah.
And then his name came over from Wave Television, Joe Knight.
Joe Knight,
was there. Van was there for a little while. And eventually Paul Rogers became the guy. And was there for a very long time.
Paul came there as just kind of a raw guy out of
straight
UK.
Out of UK. He had done UK play-by-play for the UK campus station. And he and Kay Wood had met. And, of course, he idolized Kay Wood. And Kay Wood sort of took him under his wing. And when he graduated, brought him to WHAS. It turned out at that time we were battling to get the Kentucky Colonels contract. So that's where Van went. And then we were looking for the U of L contract because Ed Shadburn knew that we really needed U of L on, and he was a U of L fan, and Wave Radio had the U of L contract, so we couldn't get that, but he could put them on FM. So WHAS, this classical music radio station, carried U of L basketball with Paul Rogers doing a play-by-play for a while. I remember the football and basketball. I remember that we staged a women's football clinic at U of L with T.W. Alley, the new coach. Alley had replaced Corso, and we were trying to help him get established. And I'd heard about the Georgia football coach, Vince Dooley, had done a football clinic for women. I thought, what a great idea.
Sure.
So I called U of L and said, "Hey, what do we do?" And so Paul Rogers, dressed in a tuxedo, and they brought me out dressed in a football uniform that was about three sizes too big, right? So I'm dwarfed in this big outfit with all these pads and stuff. And Paul's line to T.W. Alley, the coach, was, "Now, how do you turn a guy like this into a football player?" I go behind the curtain, and out steps this magnificent hunk of a left tackle or whatever.
So the ladies got their notepads out. Said, "We can do that, we can do it." That's great. Well, those were some special moments, really.
We had great fun doing things. You know, it was great freedom to, if you had an idea and you could sell it, you could do it. So one day, about 1974 or 5, I said to our program director, Jerry David Malloy, we cannot compete forever with music, with these FMs that are really coming on. About WLRS was on by then, and some other stations that were really making some inroads. We cannot, because we're AM, and you know, we don't have the kind of fidelity that FM does for music. So we need to go, well, we wrestled with going all talk in the morning and wrestled with it and wrestled with it. And finally, I just did a format and brought in and said, here's what I think we ought to do. And Jerry just said, okay. So that's how we became all talk in the morning.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I think that's how we really became an information radio station. Yeah. That was the first start toward becoming a genuine go-to full-time. Let's talk about what's going on right now. Let's seize the opportunity.
I was in the middle of it, was in the middle of it. I want to go back to one of the, we talked about sports a minute ago, about the UK and U of L. You were on the air at the time when WHAS lost the UK contract. That was not a fun time, was it?
No, it was not. You know, we had a general manager who got into a spitting contest with the Cats, and the folks over there just didn't like this guy, Sandy Gamblin. He was, you talk about train wreck. Yeah, that was really a train wreck.
Well, I was on the air at that time also. Were you? We all got flack from that, I remember a fellow, and I'm just going to intrude on your time just a moment here, but I remember getting a call, and the fellow said, you people don't realize how important this radio station and the signal is to all the Cat fans out there. He said, for example, you get out to all these 38 states at night. My father, big Cat fan, lives in Florida. And one night there was a major game on and he wanted to hear it. It's 10 o'clock at night. He can't get it on his home radio. He's out in his car. And he's sitting in the middle of this exclusive subdivision at 10:30 at night with his lights off and his engine running, listening to the game. A policeman raps on his window and says, sir, do you mind telling me what you're doing here? You're not going to believe this, officer. There's this radio station, the UK. I believe it. You're the third one I found tonight. There's another one over the hill over here. So. But that was the importance of the signal. And you got a lot of that, especially early mornings.
In the early days, we worked, you worked Monday. I worked Monday through Saturday, no matter what. Yeah. No matter what. And so Christmas morning, if it fell Monday through Saturday, I was on the air in the morning.
Yeah.
And the good news about that was that when my kids would wait for me to get off the air and come home to see whether or not Santa had actually come. There was a fella from Kentucky who had moved from here to San Francisco, and he worked as a night watchman. And in the dead of winter, on December 25th, the sun was really late coming up in San Francisco, and that sky wave still worked.
Wow.
And he would listen to me in the morning. He would call the radio station. I'd put him on the air, and he'd say, Merry Christmas to all the family back in Kentucky.
Wow.
Yeah. I remember Milton getting calls from ships at sea. Literally, you remember the old line, all the ships at sea?
Yeah. Let's talk about, you talked about the state fair. That was a important time to meet a lot of the people. But Kentucky Derby. Let's talk about Kentucky Derby for a minute. You did many of those.
Oh, gosh. My first, we got a call from Jim Bolus, who at that time had been a sports writer at the Courier-Journal and Louisville Times, and had gone to work as the public relations director, publicity director, I think, at Churchill Downs. And he called Hugh and said, what would you think about Wayne doing the morning show out at Churchill Downs? So
in the center of things again.
So that fall, for the fall meet, the first week of the fall meet, I went out to Churchill and we did the morning show.
Oh, not just for the Derby. You did
upstairs in the press box.
Yes.
And they would bring people over to me. And one day, Kaywood said, you know, you're in the wrong spot, Perky. You need to be on the backstretch. That's where all the action is. So for the spring meet, Derby week, I moved out there to a little place in the, I guess it was the press lounge. It was a little, not more than a 15x15 sort of room where they kept coffee and stuff. And I did the morning show.
And everybody came right by there.
Right by there on the way to the track and coming back. You know, it was right at the convergence of two of the main paths.
To the barns and the track.
And the Derby horses always were in 41, 42, 43. Mostly the filly horses in 43, but barns 41 and 42 were the primary horses. Barns for the horses that came in, particularly out of town. And in those days, lots of the Derby horses raced elsewhere and then would come in for that week or 10 days. Kaywood used to tell a story about a trainer, maybe of tap shoes, who would not come in until Friday. Drove the guys like Kaywood crazy.
Sure, it couldn't seem more guys.
It was so quiet. I remember vividly the day that Carl Schultz.
Schmidt.
Tom Meeker had become the new president of Churchill Downs. Had been on the board, he was their attorney, and they elected him the president of Churchill Downs, and they were going through all the changes, and Lynn was leaving, and Tom was in, and they decided they were going to open things up. And suddenly I realized, that they moved me first from my place, my spot, which I thought was perfect, over to a new spot.
Oh.
Now, they tried to make me feel better about that by putting a big sign on the outside with my face on the caricature on the soil, Perky Broadcasting Live. And as Carl used to say, we always give you the A-list guests. We always make sure that you get the, you know. Well, it was in the central location, and I was in the middle of everything, and people did come in, and I was able to snatch and grab. I'm an opportunist, you know. If something's going on, I want to talk about it. Let's take advantage of it. Let's seize the moment. And so that was a really good place for me because I can be flexible and I try to just, I'm the most spur-of-the-moment guy I've ever met in my whole life. And suddenly I realized that WAMZ is also on the air out there. And there was another radio station, maybe. And I went jumping up in Carl Schmidt's face saying, what the heck are you doing? This is my territory. I invented this. This is my tour. What are you doing? And he said, Perky, my job is to get every radio station out here. I got no sympathy from him whatsoever.
But you're right, you were the first, but many did come out, and that was a prize thing. Well, let me ask you this, with all the, you became, I don't know about close friends, but certainly on a first name basis with many of the trainers and owners. They all knew you, and I think many of them wanted to be on with you in the morning. They were willing to share.
They were. It was a great compliment was paid. Kaywood said to me that you know, a lot of them were listening on the way out, and Kaywood said to me one day, he said, you get things out of these guys that none of us can get.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Wow.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
Well, now let me ask you this. So your retirement fund was enriched greatly then from all the Derby winners you had. All that information, right?
I had, in all those years, I had one Derby when I actually had more money walking out than I had coming in.
Sort of like everybody else. Yes. Well, it always amazed me that how these experts have so much information and nobody knows.
The greatest thrill for me was the Derby 1973. Milton Metz had always been the anchor, you know, and before him, well, it was a legendary assignment. But Milton was going to move to television, and he was going to interview the celebrities in Celebrity Row, and it was a choice for him. I mean, he was moving and shaking with the movers and shakers.
He was great at that.
And really good at it. And I was invited to be the host for the day, so which meant I got to work beside Kaywood, you know, all day long. And it was 1973. Secretary
of the day meant that you started early in the morning and then just broadcast all the events throughout. Till the end of the Derby.
Did the morning show from 5 to 9 on the backstretch, and then from 9 to 10, we went back to the studio and did some special programming, and then from 10 till the end of the day, we were on a dead run. Yep. It was just a, you know, with people everywhere.
But a great time.
Gosh, it was a thrill. And I got to work with Kaywood, and I can hear him now, you know. When Secretary and Sham turned, turned for home, and he's saying, and here they come to me now, Sham on the inside. Oh,
yeah, that was great.
It was a thrill.
Yeah, that was my first Derby, by the way.
Was it?
Yeah, first broadcast with HAS.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll tell you another story. We were on the roof there. Byron Crawford and I had just finished our duties. We were done. So we got to stand while you worked. We got to stand and watch it, you know. And we had both bought a $2 ticket on Sham because we saw, you know, the horses came out. Sham came out. All right. Secretariat came out. Byron looked at me. He says, is that Secretariat? Yeah. Reached in his pocket, took out his $2 ticket, and tore it up.
That's funny.
Great. Yeah, of course, the rest was legend. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So you had some great Kentucky Derby times, and that was...
It was really fun. Yeah, it was fun.
Let's talk for a second about the Crusade for Children, vital part of WHAS, and you were the head of that and emceed that for many years.
Learned a bunch of lessons. How much time do we have?
Oh, we're fine.
You sure?
Yep.
Okay. When I come here from Mobile, Alabama, and we had just done a March of Dimes telethon, had raised about $60,000. The star of the Virginian was our featured big star. And we'd raised about $65,000, and everybody was thrilled to death.
Well, sure.
So I came in and was told about the crusade, and I thought, well, I was pretty blasé because I thought, I know about it. I've done marathons. Yeah, I don't know all this stuff, you know? So I was assigned the overnight gig. I got to introduce folks, you know.
Oh, yeah.
We went on at 10 o'clock then, and so I went on at 1 or 2. The first 4 hours were pretty well programmed.
One, two in the morning.
Yeah, yeah. And was on till, I don't know, 6 or 7, I guess. And then went home and turned it on and watched. I was fascinated.
Yeah.
You know, and I couldn't believe the numbers that began to come. And, oh, gosh, what a remarkable thing. So that in, I guess, the winter of 79-80, when it was decided that Jim Walton was going to retire, he had been moved from Morning Show in 1970 to become the executive director of the Crusade for Children and its host. And he was going to retire. Phyllis Knight was going to replace him and become the executive director of the Crusade. Phyllis and Eleanor Bingham took me to lunch and said, would you like to become the MC? Are you kidding? You know?
Sure.
Of course. Absolutely. So Crusade rolls around. Crusade weekend gets there, you know, and we're in rehearsals, and I'm scared because, you know, Jim, after the 79 Crusade, he pat me on the back on the way out the door and said, good luck with doing 27, son. So Crusade is here, and I don't realize that I am silly putty. I am so scared. I kept running to the men's room and, you know, and going through rehearsal and all stuff, and I was scared. I don't know where I get this idea that I am so important, but I was scared to death that if I didn't do it right, it would all come apart and the Crusade would die and it'd be all my fault, you know? I don't know where that pressure comes from. So we go through rehearsals, and I'm sick in my stomach, and I'm scared and sweating and all this stuff. I just knew that the show would open, the band would play, and the dancers would dance, and the singers would sing, and it would be this crescendo moment, and the little child would come walking up to me, and I'd pick him up, and I'd burst into tears and choke up and wouldn't be able to say anything at all, and everything would die. It'd be all my fault. Well, the show opened. We're now in the studios at WHAS. We moved from the auditorium over to the studios, and the band plays, and they're fabulous. And the dancers have never performed better. And the motet singers were spectacular, you know. And the moment comes, and the young kids, dancers part, and up comes Timmy. Timmy is a 5-year-old spina bifida kid on his crutches, with a smile, Jack, that lit up the studio. And he's walking up to me, and I'm feeling the emotions coming, you know.
Yeah.
It's rising up, and, you know, I know I get a lump in my throat, and I reached down to pick him up. And you remember how sharp 5-year-old fingernails are? I reached down to pick him up, and Timmy grabbed my nose. And he cut my nose. And apparently the pain just pulled everything out. The tension was gone. And we had a great time. I'd introduce the next act and run over to the side. They'd dab my nose. And I'd introduce the next act and we'd dab my nose.
And it nobody knew.
But, you know, I was so uptight and so nervous and so concerned that I was there all night. And the next day, and the next day. Now, we had a new program director who had said to me something like, Wayne, it'd be a great idea if you would just come to the studio over and just do the morning show. Everybody want to talk to you about what a great weekend it was. I said, Denny, I won't be physically able to do that. And I was right. But you remember that the Redmen always closed the Crusade.
From New Albany.
Right. They would come in and in their Indian gear, and they'd dance and war whoop and stuff, you know. And then Gary, whose last name just left me, Gary always did their report. Gary's a big, tall guy, kind of quiet, but big voice, but a very nice man. So I'm going to tell a story on myself. I'm standing there. I am physically beat. I'm exhausted because I had not slept a moment. I had left the studio. I'd been there for whatever hours it was. I'm physically exhausted. And I looked over, and there was Jim Walton. And I thought, what? Wait, this is my turn, Jim. You know, feeling, I'm telling you, I'm feeling guilty now telling a story, but I'm thinking, you know, this is my show. And I realized that at that moment that I was going to have to introduce Gary to do the report. And for this, to save my life, I could not remember his name.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm thinking, what am I going to do when they finish and throw it to me? And I've got, what am I going to do? And then, as they said, and now let's go over to Wayne for the report. I said, Jim, because Gary and Jim had this running gag about Gary being Jim's illegitimate son for like 10 years or whatever. I said, Jim, why don't you come out and do this one? Well, he was really pleased, you know, that
it got you off the hook.
It took me right off the hook.
That's going with the flow again, isn't it? That's great, great, great stories, great stories. You did the Crusade for how many years then?
1980.
Well,
yeah.
Great stuff, yeah. Great stuff. Let's talk just a minute here. When you first came to WHAS, it was a Bingham operation.
Yes.
Okay. You have much contact with the Binghams themselves, the family?
No, actually, I had been on the air for about 3 months. One morning, my song ended just before, we're still playing music, my song ended just before it was time to introduce Paul Clark for the 7 o'clock newscast. So I had about a minute to kill. And I said, you know, Paul, I've been here 6 months now, and I've heard forever about what a big, happy family this was. And do you know that not once in all this 6 months has Barry Bingham Sr. or Barry Bingham Jr. or Simon Cannon or any of those guys ever walked down to this end of the block and shoved out his old hairy paw and said, Wayne, welcome to the family. Paul laughed and said, well, you know, and we went on to the newscast. So it's about 45 minutes later, and I'm in the studio, and we're still playing music, and I'm digging in the racks trying to figure out what I'm going to play next or where that song is that I need to play next. And I hear the studio door open behind me, and I turn to look, and there's this tall, skinny, red-haired guy with a handlebar mustache striding in, and I grab my record, and I turn back, and I'm about to say to him, who the heck are you, and what are you doing in my studio, when he says, hi, Wayne, I'm Barry Bingham, Jr., welcome to the family. My dad would be here, but he's in the Far East.
Wow, wow, wow. Well, they were a great family and did a lot of good things for you.
Yeah.
No question about that. But you were also there then during the transition when the Binghams broke up their holdings and sold and broke up the broadcast properties and Clear Channel took over the radio station. Let's talk tell about that transition a little bit. Anything you remember about that transition?
Were you still there?
Yes.
Were you part of the...
Actually, I had left, and I was coming back right at that time. I had worked, and then I came back in 1984, and this happened in 1985. In fact, they were talking about it, and one day I was coming into work, and I saw Barry Bingham Sr. walking down Broadway toward the Courier, and he was deep in thought, and I thought, well, I haven't heard anything about the broadcast properties in a while. I wonder what they're... And that's the day they announced that they were breaking everything up.
Wow. Yeah. There were lots of stories about that. George Gill, until he died, would tell me that one of the most remarkable experiences he ever had was because of that sale. We had when we heard that Clear Channel was the number one pursuer, guys on the air began, on WAMZ and WHAS, began to get phone calls and letters from guys all over America saying, Clear Channel, those guys are not good operators. And
at this time, though, they were not the giant that they became. They were not a small. I think WHAS was kind of the one of the stars in their crown at that time.
They had
San Antonio, of course. They were San Antonio and had WOAI, I think, or something.
Yes,
there.
Which is a 50 KW, right?
Yeah, so, and a station in New Orleans, I believe.
Right. But, and I think they might have been in one or two other markets, but they were less than five.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And they were really, we were going to become their flagship, they thought. But we began to hear that those guys are vultures. They will pick the meat off the bones and throw the carcass on the market. And if you're making over $25,000 a year, you better find another job.
Wow.
So Milton Metz wrote a letter to Mr. Bingham Sr. and said, you know, your family has built an institution here, and I'm sure you don't want your legacy to be destroyed by bad operators. So you might want to investigate these people a little more thoroughly. George, as George Gill tells it, he heard from Barry Singer, who said, George, find out about this. He calls Lowry Mays, who was the chief of Clear Channel Communications. Found him on a Texas A&M reunion trip to China. And said, you have an insurrection here, and if you want to buy these radio properties, you better get yourself to Louisville, Kentucky. The guy got on a plane and flew to Louisville, and we met in the big conference room.
Wow.
There was Bob Shearer, who was general manager of WHAS-WAMC, and Lowry Mays on one side of this big, big conference table, and ringed around the other side were about 15, 16, 17 of us. And I want to tell you, there were no holds barred. I mean, people were firing at him from all directions. We have a really important property here. We are a leader in broadcasting in America. We are the pioneers. We are da-da-da-da, you know. And we understand that you're bad guys. And the man was unflappable. Lowry sat there and listened quietly to every single person and continually said, we think you're really, really good. And we just want to help you be even better. We, I don't know about the rumors you're hearing, but they're not true. You're going to become the most important cog in our wheel. I mean, it was an amazing experience.
Wow. Yeah. And that certainly was true in the early days there. I mean, the station was pretty autonomous. There was not a lot of interference from Clear Channel in the early days.
And I really believe that was because of the strength of the manager,
right.
Bob Shearer.
Yeah, right.
I think he was standing between us and What happened in broadcasting is pretty sad. What happened was that guys like you and me became viewed as expensive rather than assets, you know. Rather than being a positive, you became an expense. And so how can we do more with fewer?
This is just a layman speaking, but it seemed to happen as Clear Channel grew more and things became, you became a part of a balance sheet as opposed to a property that was producing money or being a part of the community.
Yeah. I agree with that.
Yeah.
I had a great time. You know, I had the opportunity to do the morning show all over America and all over the world, really. I did the morning show from London. one of the most fun promotions we ever did was dreamed up by Take a Trip Skip Essick.
Yes.
Who used to call me On the Plane Way.
Yeah. Skip was the program director, yeah.
Yes. So that when the Broadway show, the guy with the mask.
Oh, Phantom of the Opera.
Phantom of the Opera was going to premiere at Kentucky Center for the Arts. And Skip said, you know what we ought to do? Let's have a contest in which we award somebody an opportunity to see the Phantom of the Opera, the first act, in the Kentucky Center, and then we'll fly them to London and let them see the second half in the theater in London. So we had a contest, and we got a fabulous winner. Woman turned out to be a Dickensophile. She collected all these Dickens things and loved Charles Dickens. And the hotel that Skip had picked out, the Tower Thistle Hotel, was right next door to an old tavern that Dickens himself used to frequent. So it was a great
place. So was that a luck of the draw? Was it a draw?
Yeah,
just luck of the draw.
Yeah. Enter.
No writing
draw.
An essay.
Yes.
Or no.
Wow. She was thrilled to death. Great winner. So we're trying to figure out how we're going to do this. The plan is that I'll do the morning show in Louisville. Skip and I will jump on a plane. We'll fly to London, land at Heathrow, get to the Tower Hotel and the Tower Thistle Hotel, and set up and be ready to go on the air and broadcast at 5 o'clock the next morning. So we're in Skip's office, and we're poring over this map of London. We're trying to decide, do we take the tube? Do we get a cab? How do we manage to make this thing happen and get there in time to set up and check it out and be on the air at 5 o'clock in the morning? My phone rings at my desk, and I go answer it. And this voice says, Wayne, this is John Van Meter. I understand from Jerry Abramson that you're coming to London. Well, John Van Meter had been on the Small World story, had been on the ballet board with Madeline Abramson, and they had become friends. He worked for Ashland Oil and had become the president of Ashland International, headquartered in London. And Jerry had said to me about 2 weeks before, you know, there's a guy from Kentucky over there named John Van Meter who probably could help you find people from Kentucky who are living over there to be guests on your show.
Wow.
So John said, hey, Wayne, I understand you're coming to London. Can I help you? And I said, well, I figured this guy's a grown-up. He's capable of saying no. Could you pick us up at the airport? And he said, let me get back to you. So a couple of minutes later, I get a phone call from a woman, said, Mr. Perky, this lovely English lady, who wanted to know when we were arriving, how many of us were coming, what time and what flight, of course, and how many pieces of luggage would we have. And so Skip and I clear customs, and there standing is a uniformed chauffeur. He throws our stuff in the back of his car, whips us off to the to the hotel. We've got an hour to spare. And because of that, we had, because of John's connections, we had the guy who was the Arab sheikhs who bought Harrods.
Yes.
At that time, he was their spokesman. He was the spokesperson for Harrods. And then during the terrible incident, when Princess Diana was killed, he became a spokesperson for the Saudi prince. At that point, he was the spokesperson for Harrods, and he came on the show. That. We had somebody from Madame Tussauds Gallery. Oh, wow. We had a beef eater from across, you know, at the tower. It was a great, great trip. We had a great experience. And John and I became very good friends.
Sure. Yeah.
So that,
you had that knack. You throughout your whole career, people like that who were heads of companies or whatever, it was your knack and the station, and that, you had many opportunities like that. That was great.
It was fun. So we did the show in Quito, Ecuador. Mm-hmm. Went down with Peter Morin on a mission to try to bring an exhibit of Ecuadorian art back to the Speed Museum and then tour of the country. That didn't quite work, but it was fun to go. Did the show with Abrams and the gang down in La Plata, Argentina, and went to the plaza where the mothers and grandmothers walked because of the missing children.
Yeah.
Went to Montpellier a couple of times and Mainz a couple of times.
Sister cities.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Did the show from Paris and London.
On the plane, Wayne.
Yeah, take a trip, Skip.
Good stuff.
And of course, we got to go to lots of the bowl games. Did the Fiesta Bowl, you know, when we were on the air from local time, 3 a.m. to 7 a.m. was kind of funny, asking coaches to come out.
And Louisville beat Alabama. That was a big move. Yeah, yeah. Big start of stuff.
Right. It was kind of funny. We go with the basketball team to tournaments and things, you know, and the guys that would show up would be the newest guys on the staff. The rookie.
Sure, you're starting early in the morning, yeah.
Would come to be our
guests. You'd go to the Final Fours and all those.
But, you know, Van Vance and Paul Rogers were great about coming to be on the show with me. And you know, they did the game the night before. They're going to have another game that afternoon or evening, but they were real troopers. They were.
This is a little out of sequence, but I want to give another guy credit here. I think when you did the Derby things, a guy named John Asher was a big help for that too, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. Terrific guy. He's a good friend.
Good friend.
Yeah.
Well, Wayne, you had a remarkable career.
Amazing.
You were on WHAS from 1969
to 1999.
Wow. Yeah. Good career.
Yeah.
Anything you want to say to kind of sum up all those years? We've shared a lot of stories and a lot of information.
I'll tell you a story. We flunked Florida and flunked, you know, Flyway. So we're back in town.
This is after you left WHAS.
Yeah. So this is about 2007, I guess. And I'm back in town. I'm reconnected with folks. Hey, we're back. We're living here. And I'd run into Abramson, who said, well, why don't you meet me for lunch for tomorrow? So I go down to City Hall, and I'm meeting him. And we're walking out the back door. And a woman named Judy Rosenblum, who had worked for the Courier-Journal, was walking out. And Jerry said, that's the best speechwriter I've ever had. And as she walked away, she turned back and said, Wayne, you ought to come join us this weekend. All the old Louisville Times reporters and folks who work there are going to meet up at Bob Hill's Hidden Hill Farm for a big reunion. She said, you know, we had no idea how lucky we were to be living at that time, to be working there at the time. And it's true. We had no idea. We were kind of in just a magical era.
It was, yes.
It was a magical era, you know. I promised myself I wouldn't be one of those old farts who said, well, we didn't do it that way when I was there, you know. But we didn't do it that way when we were there. I think that the guys at WHAS are still trying really hard to hang on to that. But, you know.
It's a different atmosphere.
It is, you know.
Well, and you were a...
Well, Milton Metz invented talk radio.
Yeah.
And he never presented one side of an issue.
Yeah.
And he was really good about pushing up some wild, crazy statement and saying, oh, wait a minute, how can you substantiate that, you know? One of the funniest things that ever happened with Metz, I may tell you the story. No, I'm not going to tell you this.
Go ahead, that's
No, I'm not.
Well, Metz had an agreement. I think we all had our own egos and everything, but I think that was an era where also you recognized that other people contributed. You talked about your team a while ago, you know.
Yes.
You were obviously the head of that team, but you recognized that each one of those players had something to contribute, and you would be able to step aside and let them do their thing. That
was For example, nice. You remember the first time we were ever rained out, the great balloon race was ever rained out. Rocky Aoki of Benihana Restaurants had won the race the year before. And he came in, and he brought Flip Wilson with him. And that year, it rained torrents the whole week, remember? So they eventually called off the race. But Ken Schultz and Flip Wilson together did one of the funniest half hours I've been, I think has ever been on radio.
I wish that was in the archives somewhere. That would be great.
They were wonderful. The next year, Rocky comes back. Ken had become the official meteorologist for the Great Balloon Race. And we're at the race meeting that morning. It's 5 o'clock in the morning, and they're standing around talking about can they fly, can they not fly, because the winds were pretty iffy. They were right up there borderline. And Ken comes out and says, "I don't know if we're going to get it to go or not. It might just be past that borderline." And Rocky said, "Oh, come on, man, let's go." And I said, "Rocky, they're saying the winds are going to be really tough." And Rocky, who had raced boats and planes and cars and everything in the whole world, turned to me just straight face and said, "Hey man, we die.
Oh wow.
Rocky, I have 5 kids and a big mortgage.
No way. Well, it's been great sharing with you, Wayne. Thanks for taking the time to share all these memories. I'm sure we could go on for days and
we
days
could.
And days.
Yes, because we were together a long
That's
time.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Thank you very much. Good
Thank
job.
You. Yeah.
See you later.
Thanks. Okay, how long have we been going? Holy smoke.
Can I shut the... Oh, there we go.